This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Amber, there's a certain glow that's coming from your side of the table, lighting up the room.
And it's not because I'm pregnant. It's because I'm getting engaged.
Amber's
I am engaged. Sorry.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, a woman who has never once in her life lip-synced, Kathleen Porter McGee.
That's because I've never sung publicly.
you could be lip syncing right. in your comments.
Yeah.
You could have pre-recorded your arguments for this podcast.
Right, exactly.
That would be very elaborate. In some ways, we do pre-record our comments, I guess. But anyways, you get my point.
Yeah.
So I understand that Beyonce was quite impressive at the Super Bowl, although I believe that, like me, you did not actually watch the Super Bowl.
I didn't. No, actually, I was flying back from Disney. So
Disney World.
You were on an airplane.
You were at Disney World, so at least you were partaking in American pop culture in some way.
I was.
You figured out that going to Disney World over Super Bowl weekend and flying back during the Super Bowl saves a lot of money.
Oh my God, yes it does. So note to anybody who is not a football fan, that is the weekend to go.
Yeah. Now, I was at a school a few weeks ago, awesome school, and they were, you know, they'll remain nameless because the principal was complaining to me that sometimes they have a diverse population and that they're sort of middle class, upper middle class parents will at times take kids out of school to bring them to Disney World. Because everybody knows there's certain times of the year during the school week when it is cheaper to go to Disney World. And I think that somebody should call out Disney World on this, that they are encouraging American kids to skip school. And that's not right.
It's straight up market values there, Mike. I mean, supply and demand, right? There's a high demand during vacation weeks. Come on.
But what comes first, Kathleen? I just think the president should say, shame on you, Disney World.
I pulled my four-year-olds. I pulled all three of my kids out of their preschool classes to take them to Disney World.
Preschool, I think we can let that slide.
Yeah.
Preschool. See, I could pull my kid out of his play school because he doesn't learn anything anyway. So it doesn't really matter. He can play anywhere.
Right.
Okay. We got to going on. We Kathleen here, author of our Common Core Watch blog. We are, of course, going to be a little heavy on the Common Core and related issues today. Let's do it. Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
This week, we here at the Fordham Institute released our commentary and feedback on Draft 2 of the Next Generation Science Standards. What did we find?
We are still underwhelmed by the second public draft of the Next Generation Science Standards. There are still a couple of pretty serious problems with it. One of them is that the critical science content still takes a backseat to science practices. Obviously, in science in particular, practices are important.
What do you mean by practices?
So being able to ask and answer questions about data and really being able to engage with the content, with the data.
Doing experiments.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are all really important things, but they need to be in service of the content and not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And our judgment, the judgment of our reviewers, was that it was not the other way around. Mm-hmm. The practices were forced in often very awkward ways onto literally every single standard mm-hmm. in a way that often confused or made the content really seem like an afterthought. Mm-hmm. So that was probably the most serious problem. And there were some other critical issues as well. So we're hoping that the drafting team will really take the time they need to get these where they need to be.
You're being pretty diplomatic here, aren't you, Kathleen? I mean, let me put it a little bit straighter as I understand it. They still suck. Is that fair, Kathleen? If these were final today, we would have a hard time telling states, at least most states, unless they have really bad science standards, to adopt them, right?
Yeah, we would not encourage the states with the best science standards to adopt the draft as it currently stands.
So this is going to be interesting. Look, at the end of the day, the number one reason we support the Common Core standards in English and math is because they're very good standards.
Mm-hmm.
They're not perfect, and we did find, at least in English, that there were a handful of states that we thought had even better standards. But, these were still honor grades standards for reading, for English and math. We are a long way from that right now with science.
Yep.
But there's one more cut to go. So here's hoping. All right, topic number two.
On Tuesday morning, we hosted the George W. Bush Institute's discussion of school leadership in an event called Operating in the Dark. In it, panelists suggested that our focus on teacher quality has blinded us to principal quality. What are your thoughts?
First of all, I'm very disappointed that nobody used the phrase at the event, "I'm the decider." I'm the principal and I'm the decider. Do you remember that from the George W. Bush days? I'm the decider. Yes. Okay. Anyways, that just came to me now. Look, very, very rich conversation and an important study that came out from the Bush Institute. We were really happy to host them at Fordham. This is not the first time that someone's come out with a report saying that states don't have their eye on the ball when it comes to leadership. In fact, we had a very similar report about 10 years ago that came to similar conclusions, but they were able to get some very interesting data from the states on their policies and on the kinds of information they collect. And what they find is, first of all, most states still, stupidly, in my opinion, have these barriers to entry that don't make a lot of sense, saying you must be a teacher to become a principal and you must get a master's degree in educational leadership. These barriers that mostly just benefit the ed schools that keep churning out these master's in educational administration degrees. On the same time, most states do very little to nothing on quality. They don't even know how many people are graduating from these programs or where they end up, or what, much less whether or not they are having an impact in their schools in terms of effectiveness. So all of these reforms that we've talked about around teacher effectiveness and teacher quality and reforming ed schools on teachers, we're now starting to focus in finally on same sort of things for leaders.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I'm really torn about some of the barriers to entry thing. I agree with you, and generally I like to lower barriers to entry for both teachers and for principals. Although I will say it's hard for me to imagine a principal being a really strong instructional leader or being a really strong leader having never been in the classroom him or herself.
Yeah, so. And look, you know, Deb Gist, the state superintendent in Rhode Island, was making that case today. She was saying, look, I just don't buy the CEO model here. I think especially in a small building like most elementary schools, that person needs to be the instructional leader, but it doesn't have to be the principal as the instructional leader, does it? Especially in like a huge high school.
I don't know. If the principal's in charge of hiring and firing teachers, how can a principal effectively make those decisions? Are they going to defer entirely to the dean or assistant principal to make those decisions? It feels like there needs to be some demonstration of instructional competence on the part of the principal. I mean, that said, I'm not a big fan of heavy regulations that say here are all of the hoops that you need to jump through before you can be a teacher or before you can be a principal, that one seems important.
And the other thing that's clear, and I know you feel this way, Kathleen, is that all this effort around teacher effectiveness, particularly mandating these you know, very strict kinds of teacher evaluations, actually gets in the way of principal quality, because we have created we keep turning the principal's job into being a mid-level bureaucrat who just has to take orders from above. Even now, about here's exactly precisely how you have to do your teacher evaluations. And by the way, we're not even going to give you much discretion. We're going to have other people come in and evaluate your teachers for you. I mean, you can understand why it's hard to get high quality people if you're not giving them any autonomy to actually run their schools.
Yeah, that I completely agree with. I mean, I think a lot of the teacher quality stuff has completely taken the leader out of the role that they should be playing in the school building. And I think that is a disaster waiting to, if not already happening.
I guess maybe the reason that the phrase "I'm the decider" didn't come up today is because, frankly, they're not.
They're not. Yeah.
Boom. Comes full circle. Love it. Okay. Topic number three.
Late last week, Alabama announced that it would exit both Common Core testing consortia. Was this unexpected? And what could this mean for the future of the standards?
I mean, I don't know if it was unexpected in Alabama. I mean, maybe they knew this was coming. I have to say that I'm not surprised that there are some states considering going another direction for a lot of different reasons. One of the reasons is that they have to make these decisions about what assessments they're going to be administering in 2015, and they need to make those decisions quickly. And as of right now, they might not have as much information from the testing consortium as they need to...
The Common Core testing.
The Common Core, thank you, testing consortia as they need. That said, I really sincerely hope that states aren't just taking the path of least resistance. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a potential problem, and we want to make sure that states are holding the line on quality and making sure that whatever assessment is administered... And I frankly don't care if it's a consortium or not. I care if it's aligned and if it's going to be, you know, a valid and reliable assessment of student mastery of the standards.
You know, I wouldn't go quite that far. I mean, it is a disappointment when we are not using common assessments. I mean, this was part of the reason that this is exciting, is to be able to make comparisons across state lines. And so that is a loss, but we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, we've always predicted that when the rubber meets the road, we're going to see some states drop off. So far, two states have dropped out of the test testing consortia, and it's Utah and Alabama among the most conservative, most Republican states in the country. That shouldn't be too much of a surprise. But you're right, Kathleen. What are they going to do instead? Surely they and their testing vendors will say that they're going to update their tests to be aligned to the new Common Core standards, if they're in fact keeping those standards. And we have reason to be skeptical that that alignment is going to be for real.
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to watch this. But I think, you know, we were talking about this with Checker earlier, that many states do have to make this decision soon. If they're not going to use the Common Core test 2 years from now, they need to be letting out contracts right now. And so I think this is likely to be repeated, at least in a handful of other states, before the spring is over. All right. Thank you, Kathleen. Great job playing Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Pamela. It's now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Amber, there's a certain glow that's coming from your side of the table, lighting up the room.
And it's not because I'm pregnant. It's because I'm getting engaged.
I am engaged.
Sorry.
Amber's engaged.
I'm getting married. That's how that works.
Whoa.
I'm just a little bit excited.
Okay. Hold on. One step at a time here, people. Okay. One step at a time. You are engaged.
I am engaged.
You are not pregnant.
I'm not pregnant. Because the glow, you know, when you started with that, I'm like, these people probably know I'm not married, so I don't want them thinking I've got that kind of glow.
Oh, my God. Still very exciting, Amber.
Yes, very exciting.
We're so happy for you.
Thank you so much.
And who's the lucky guy?
His name is Rob. He does home appraisals and real estate. He's not in education, which I love.
Yes.
No offense, Kathleen, but
when I got engaged, she wasn't in education either.
Watch out.
Yeah, I'm okay with not talking shop when I get home.
All right, so what I want to know is, does Rob listen to the Education Gap show?
I told him that he should probably listen today, because I knew I was going to tell you guys at the staff meeting. I said, if I had my druthers, I bet they're going to mention it on the show
nice.
Today.
So.
Yes, he'll be
very
listening.
Excited.
This time.
You know, Amber, you know, people that listen to the show, they really feel like they get to know us. It's a very kind of intimate thing. And so I just will warn you that there may be some people out there who expect to be invited to the wedding.
Oh, is that right? Rob said, I bet hearts are breaking. I'm like, no, hon, there were no hearts broken right. as a result of this engagement.
But maybe anyway. We can webcast it. Live tweet it.
We'll think about that.
Right.
That's great.
All right. Anyway. All right. Well, I guess we should talk about a study.
Got to talk about research. That's okay. Right. Got a new report out from Credo. Charter school growth and replication is the name. The primary question Credo asked this time around is the academic success or failure of a charter school during its initial years a strong predictor of whether it will excel or struggle in later years? So how important are those initial years?
And by the way, this is important because in that original Credo study that all the anti-charter people like to cite, right? There were huge differences that if you took out the charters from their first year where they tend to have lackluster
struggle.
Performance, the picture looks a lot brighter for charter
looks
schools.
Better. All right. That's right.
Go ahead.
Thank you for that little additional layer.
I will not charge against your time.
Thank you very much. 167 charter management organizations, CMOs, were studied, about 1,300 schools. So they compared the five-year performance of students in CMOs and independent charter schools to their virtual twins. This is virtual twin methodology they've worked out. So they're comparing them to the kids who are in the same traditional public schools that the charter school students would have otherwise attended. All right, four key findings. One, initial charter performance for the first or second years is predictive of later performance. Mm-hmm. Roughly 80% of charter schools in the bottom quintile of performance remain low performance through their fifth low performance performers through their fifth year. 94% of schools that begin in the top quintile stay there over time as well, up to 5 years. Reminds us of our bottom of the barrel.
Right, our bad schools immortal study
immortal
by David
report.
Stite. Yes.
Yes. Anyway, another aside. Elementary schools are more likely to show an upward pattern of growth. Okay, so if you're good, you stay good. If you're not so good, you stay bad. Finding two, CMOs on average are pretty average, not dramatically different from non-CMO schools in terms of student learning gains. But as in any study, once you peel back the layers, there's a range of quality. Across 167 CMOs, 43% outpace the learning gains of their local traditional public school in reading, 37% do so in math. Yet a third have average learning gains worse in reading, and half have average gains worse in math. Finding three, two-thirds of CMOs start new schools that are of the same or better quality as their existing portfolio. However, the lowest third of CMOs replicate more rapidly than the middle or high-performing CMOs.
Well, so that might be a relationship, right? You go too fast, quality suffers.
Right. Last finding that I'll mention, because there are like 15 findings. EMOs posted significantly higher learning gains than either CMOs, independent charter schools, or traditional public schools.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So EMOs being the for-profit variety.
For-profit variety. Analysts have a number of recommendations, but their primary one is to warn authorizers to pay close attention to charter school performance even early in their operation. Be willing to close them quickly, since they say poor first performance in the first or second year gives way to third and fourth and fifth year. Mm-hmm. So that's that.
Wow, a lot of stuff to chew on. You know, we were really interested in this from a policy perspective, but also from an authorizing perspective. In Ohio, we authorize 11 schools, and we have seen some of those schools which are very high performing, including a KIPP school that we authorize that's in Columbus, got off to rocky starts, but were able to turn it around. So, you know, I think just a reminder that these findings hold up and are in general, but there are always
outliers.
And so if you're an authorizer, you want to be careful. Again, I mean, so the advice to sort of be very quick on the draw of closing down bad schools, I think you got to be a little careful about that. You know, I also wonder about some of these schools that sort of start bad, stay bad. They are bad on tests, but they may be bad on tests because their model is explicitly saying we're the anti-testing school. And therefore, we, you know, and this big debate, particularly when you're talking about sort of middle class neighborhoods where the kids are going to go to college regardless. And, you know, do you allow in the charter sector to have these sort of squishy progressive schools that may not look so good on tests, you know, and should that be different than how you feel about schools in urban areas where maybe it's more a matter of life and death? So these, you know, the data informs the discussion, but these more bedrock concerns going on.
We need to look at other things than standardized test scores. That's what you're saying, aren't you?
I am, yes. That's my Waldorf thing coming through. Kathleen, I mean, so you've been involved in one of these high-performing CMOs. I assume that Achievement First looks pretty good in this study. What's your take on this? Surprising at all? Or?
I mean, no, not really. The growth thing in particular, I mean, I think it makes sense that the one of the things the Achievement First struggled with is how quickly to grow. And they had this thing that we grow as fast as we can, but as slow as we must in everything that they did. They wanted to grow very quickly and to, you know, even to be able to compete with somebody like KIPP in terms of numbers of schools, but they wanted to figure out a way to do it with high quality. And they actually halted their growth at one point because the quality wasn't where they wanted it to be. And so that sort of squares with some of the findings in there. And I think probably the highest performing charter schools do pause to make sure they're getting it right before they expand.
Which is interesting because they did look, I didn't put it in my minute, but they looked at super CMO networks, the ones that sort of look to spawn off additional schools. KIPP and Uncommon Schools had the strongest academic showing. White Hat Management, and I hadn't heard of this one, Responsive Education Solutions. Anyway, both of those fared poorly, not as well as.
What's interesting about that is both KIPP and Uncommon have fairly decentralized models, which is an interesting lesson. I mean, KIPP is very much grow a leader and give them all autonomy.
Yeah.
Uncommon is grow a small network and give them a lot of us. So the Uncommon networks, I think, look, I mean, obviously they have a lot of commonalities, just like the KIPP schools do, but they have a lot of autonomy.
And that squares with what we seem to know from the international data, that is, if you want to go from good to great, autonomy's got to be a big piece of it. It's still, you know, some disappointing news here for this whole movement to fund CMOs, right? I mean, the fact that we have put so much money and effort into these networks, I have to wonder if these CMOs that are largely getting on average returns are way better funded than the single site charters.
Right.
This has issues with federal policy. You're out there, you know, the Congress has to decide now every year how much money to put into the regular charter program to do startups versus the replication grants for the CMOs. The National Alliance now is on behalf of KIPP and others pushing hard for the replication stuff. You know, I mean, so raises a lot of questions here that, you know, it could be that these single site mom and pop charter schools that have been sometimes denigrated may be getting, from a cost effective perspective, maybe doing better than these networks.
And they did
maybe there's more creative ways to support them too. I mean, you can provide some of the back office services that KIPP and Achievement First and Uncommon are able to supply just because they are a larger CMO, and you could supply it to promising mom and pop charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. I was just going to say they did a separate analysis of the schools supported by the Charter School Growth Fund. I didn't actually dig into that because it was, you know, long enough. But for our listeners who are interested in that, for those Charter School Growth Fund schools, there's a separate piece on that.
Yeah. And I think basically very positive that they are doing a good job. And look, I mean, they're going out finding schools with strong performance records and supporting the replication. So they are doing a good job with that. All right, lots to dig in there. Hey, you know, look, it's a, like a bazillion pages long, and you summarize it in a minute. We talk about it for 5 minutes. That's not bad.
Done. So
imagine the amount of time
saved our readers and listeners. Right.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Very exciting news,
Thank
Amber.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right. Until next week.
I'm Kathleen Porter McGee.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.